And first order of business for the information of the committee today in the Senate Committee on Human Resources at 1 o'clock. They are having an informational meeting, an overview of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which and Gary Weeks, who was here and then was there and is now back here, is going to be doing the presentation, as well as Ramona Foley and Tony Peterson from Children, Adults, and Families in DHS. So if you have time, committee, and Sandy's got a few packets here of the information, we've been invited to join that committee at the dais, or you could tune in on your TV or whatever, but I think it'll be some useful information. And with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting, pharmaceutical development. This is going to be very fascinating. I'm really excited to see this. And we, please.
Take off. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer, representing Pfizer. Very pleased to be here today, and we really appreciate the committee's interest and hospitality in bringing us in. This is a follow-up to an earlier discussion that we had with the committee in which we had suggested that it might be of value to you to learn the research and development process and what went into it. And in order to do that, although we are here from Pfizer, we represent pharma as a collective today. So this is, though you may see some things that are very Pfizer-specific, that's in large part due to the fact that we're fortunate enough to bring John Swen out here. John, to my right, is the Senior Director of U.S. Science and Policy for Pfizer Global Research and Development. And he will tell you a little bit about what that means and who we are as well. But generally speaking, John will be speaking on behalf of the industry as a whole, and I want to make that clear. We're very proud of what Pfizer does, but this is a collective effort here. So with that, I will not take up any more of your time, but let the certified smart guy speak. So John Swen from Pfizer Global Research and Development.
Thanks, Russ. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Again,
thank you for coming.
My pleasure. And again, just to reiterate what Russ said, thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the committee for taking the time. What I'd like to do this morning is really take you through some PowerPoint slides. And rather than this becoming a lecture, I'd much rather have it be a conversation. And so I would encourage you to interrupt, ask questions, particularly if you see something you don't like, and really engage you around some of these issues. Let me just say a little bit about my background.
Well, first, on that point, if I can interrupt for a minute, I think it would be, for the purpose of this presentation, I think we can suspend normal protocol, and if you have a question, just go direct to the question, not through the chair. Just
great.
For purpose of this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just very briefly, my background, so you'll understand at least a little bit where I'm coming from. I've been at Pfizer for 2 years, and before that I spent 3 years working in state government. I was the director of economic development working for Governor Lincoln Almond. And then before that, I ran a biotechnology company in Switzerland. I founded and ran a company called Modex Therapeutique, which was premised on the use of cellular medicine. Before that, I ran clinical research, manufacturing, and development at a larger biotech company here in the U.S. called Cytotherapeutics, based in Providence, Rhode Island. And my educational background is I was an English major in college, and then I went to MIT, of all places, for an English major, and I got a degree in computer science and also in business. So my background is pretty diverse, and as somebody who did serve for 3 years in state government, I'm fully aware of the challenges, particularly the financial challenges that you face. And I hope that this presentation will put those challenges in some context, because I think if I were to leave you with one message today, it would really be pharmaceuticals are the solution to the costs, the high costs of medicine is not the problem. And to the extent that we can facilitate the creation of better and more more cost-effective pharmaceuticals. I think it's one of the few avenues we have to really manage globally the dramatically increasing costs. So what I'd like to do is again, just take you through this slide deck. I won't spend much time on this one. Pfizer's an old and proud company, and it's been involved in the healthcare business for over 150 years. PGRD is 13,000 colleagues worldwide, and we do research in every major country in the world, and we have major research and development facilities in all of the areas that you see. So three major facilities in the U.S. and a very large facility in Sandwich, England, also Nagoya, and two smaller facilities in continental Europe. So it's truly a global organization. And the reason for that is talent is not distributed. It's distributed pretty evenly. And so we really are committed to trying to get the best folks to come and work at Pfizer, and we think they're located all around the world. One of the things that I think gets lost in the process of review looking at pharmaceuticals is just how difficult making a new pharmaceutical, a new medicine is. And if you think about these very disarmingly simple pills that you see, they mask an incredibly complex product that has to work, if you think about it, across all racial and ethnic groups, across age, weight, and sex differences. It has to work in different distribution systems, in different economic systems, in different regulatory systems. And that's very difficult. And it needs to, it can't just work okay. It has to be statistically provable to be effective and safe in all those different environments, in all those different people, in all those different regulatory environments, in all those different economic systems. So it's a very, very difficult problem.
So if I can interrupt.
Sure.
Is it not, I'm not talking about distribution, marketing, or the economic side. I'm talking about the regulatory side. So it is not fair just to say, generalization, hey, if it can pass muster in the United States, it passes muster for the rest of the world.
That's correct.
Okay.
John, before you move on, I'm wondering, are you making the same pill for every country in this world, I guess, or every country that you serve?
So when you go through the regulatory process, you have to validate to an unbelievably excruciating level the specific medicine that you're proposing to introduce to that regulatory system, and you cannot deviate from that one iota. And we are constantly monitored, and we are constantly reviewing to make sure that nothing about that pill changes in any way. So one of the problems that we've had is we're beginning to see more and more people stealing our products and making our products without. It's one of the interesting issues with the TRIPS agreement. Is it's great because it provides access to intellectual property for countries around the world. But what it also does, when we file our patents, we file the composition of matter, we file the process by which we make it, we file the process by which we manufacture it. That leaves it. It makes it very easy for people to steal our products, very, very easy. And so it's one of the reasons why we're so sensitive about people violating our patents. Because when you file a patent, the process of filing a patent makes it extremely easy for those who choose not to recognize patents to steal your products. So that's the only reason that we would change any products is to or modify them would be to prevent that from happening. And we haven't done it very much thus far, but it's something that we're looking at.
What's the drug that you sell, your top volume drug?
Lipitor is our number one selling product.
So the Lipitor that you sell in America is the same as the Lipitor you sell in Mexico, is the same as the Lipitor you sell in South Africa?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So if you look at the drug industry, and we generate surprisingly little sympathy, frankly, but if you look at why should you care about the drug industry, there's really only one reason, and that is if the success of the industry in general makes your lives and the lives of your constituents better. And really, the debate should be about, you know, what are the probabilities of having a better outcome for the world with new and more innovative medicines or not. Not about, you know, a lot of other extraneous issues. And I think to the extent that when you plunk your dollar down to buy your Lipitor pill, what you're buying is these. You're not buying Lipitor. It's been bought and paid for long ago. And to the extent that you want to pay $1.50 for Lipitor, then this list gets longer. To the extent that you want to pay 50 cents for Lipitor, this gets shorter. And it's really as simple as that. And one of the things that's really exciting, and I'll talk about this a little bit in a little more depth.
John, you lost me on that.
Shortly.
Go through that. Why $1 and why 50 cents?
So, well, I mean, basically, our budget is a function of our revenues. And to the extent that we have higher revenues, we invest more in research. To the extent that we have lower revenues, we invest less in research.
So you're saying if you charge more for Lipitor, then you can do more research.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
And it really isn't, you know, there's a lot, it gets really complicated, particularly looking at pricing in different countries, and I'll address that in some detail later. But the bottom line is fairly straightforward. More revenue generates more research, which generates more products. But I just want to pause here just for a second. There has never been a richer or deeper pipeline in the industry than there is right now. And the number and the kinds of medicines that are in development right now are quite different than the kinds of medicines that were in the pipeline 10 years ago. And there is phenomenal promise. And I'll talk about that in one or two specific areas just to give you some idea. But it is a very, very exciting time, which is one of the reasons why it's frustrating for us, because we see the most promise in the history of the industry right now in new medicines, and yet we're under such assault that we're really worried about having the resources to be able to exploit some of these tremendous scientific opportunities that are out there.
Assault, how is that, John?
I'm sorry?
Assault?
If you read, I mean, I'll just give you an example. I mean, the ABC News piece by Peter Jennings was an assault on every component of our business. And, you know, for example, he says very matter-of-factly to 35 million Americans that were watching the show that Celebrex confers no GI benefit. Now, that's his prerogative. It's a free country, and we do have freedom of the press. But that flies in the face of decades of research by the best minds in the world. And for him to say that and not to get challenged on it is very discouraging to those of us who spend our lives developing these medicines and following the most rigorous process of proving that a medicine works that the human beings have ever created. The approval of drugs is the most rigorous and intellectually honest process that we've ever invented. And does that mean that you know, God himself has endorsed it? No. Is it possible that it's wrong? Yes. But is it likely? It's extremely unlikely that it's wrong. And when somebody challenges those assertions that are generated from decades of work by the finest minds in the world, you have to ask yourself, well, okay, what do you bring to the table? What does Peter Jennings know about drug development? What does he know about GI benefit? And that's what concerns me personally, is the folks that are criticizing the industry, the folks that are criticizing doctors and the scientists involved in the drug development process. Generally speaking, they have a very narrow self-interest. There's usually some very specific reason that they've got. And secondly, they rarely have the depth of background and the ability to really understand what they're saying. And that's dangerous. That's dangerous because what it does is it focuses the debate on things that aren't real. And if you say something often enough, loud enough, we all know it starts to become true. And we're really concerned about that in the research area because we see our work being mischaracterized in the most awful ways. You know, and some of the criticisms around our conduct of clinical trials. Those are moral and ethical charges that have been laid against us and other companies in the industry. And again, I can't tell you that no one has ever, you know, no clinical investigator has ever made a mistake. No clinical investigator has ever done anything dishonest. I can't say that. But I can tell you, compared to any other system that we've ever invented, It is the most decent, honorable, and well-controlled system that we've ever created. And that's what bothers me, is that's why I call it an assault, because it is focused on moral and ethical charges that I think are completely unfounded. There are legitimate issues where what's good for the industry is bad for other people, but there are very few, very, very few of those. And 95%, in my opinion, of the issues that you see, that you read about in the newspaper, are either based on complete misstatements of fact or things taken grossly out of context. And that's one of the things I want to do today, is just talk about some of that context. And that doesn't mean that after I leave, you all say, oh, you know, okay, he came in with the answers. I don't have all the answers. But what I do have is a different perspective that we see from the research point of view and the importance of doing our work.
John, on your previous slide, you know, I noticed the willpower drug is conspicuously absent from your research list. I'm disappointed to see that.
That's a very, actually, we do have a willpower drug. It's our smoking cessation compound.
Maybe have some free samples for the chair.
I hope you've got a memory product, but I can't remember why.
In fact, we do. We have a marketed memory product called Aricep, which works very well. So one of the things that's interesting, you know, in getting back to your point, because I think it's a really important one. So why do I feel like there's an assault? Well, you read in the newspaper all the time about how much money we spend on marketing and promotion, and how little we spend on R&D. And it's really interesting to me to observe compared to what. So for Pfizer, the amounts are roughly 2 to 1. We spend roughly twice as much on marketing and sales as we do on R&D. What do you guess it is for Procter & Gamble? What do you guess it is for Coca-Cola? And this is not to take a shot at those companies. They're in different businesses. But in most cases, it's 10, 20, 30, 40 to 1. And so to assert that there's somehow some kind of we violated some kind of social contract by spending twice as much on marketing and sales as we do on R&D is ludicrous. It's one of those facts. It is in fact true, but it's grossly out of context. Because compared to any other industries, you can see from this data, we invest massive amounts in R&D. You know, 4 to 5 times more as a percentage of our sales than the average industrial U.S. company. And that's because it's absolutely critical to our continued success. We cannot remain independent and successful without a rich and robust pipeline of new products constantly coming on. Because it's not like Coca-Cola. People can copy our products at a time certain, at a very definite point in time in the future. And so we know when we introduce a product, it's what day it'll go off patent. And we are facing enormous pressure as our products continually go off patent to develop new ones to replace them.
Yeah. How long does it take to go off patent?
It's 17 years in the U.S., but most of that is taken up, and I'll talk about that in more detail later. The majority of the patent life is actually taken up with the development process itself. So it takes about 10 to 12 years to develop a drug, and we file very early in the process. So most of our patent life is consumed by the process itself of developing the drug.
On your last slide, I don't need to go back, but 17% R&D, so based on an earlier comment I think I heard you make, that you spend about twice as much on marketing as R&D.
Yes, marketing, so that's all promotional activities. And
pens, coffee cups, samples,
right.
Salesman
right.
Salaries.
Right.
Magazine ads, TV ads, everything put together. So 30-35%.
Roughly, yeah. Okay. SG&A, yeah. So we do research in every, at Pfizer, and of course this is absolutely true of the industry as a whole. We do research in every important human area of human health. One of the reasons why developing drugs is so expensive is it's really complicated. And if you think about the Apollo project, the technical complexity of drug development dwarfs the technical complexity of the Apollo moonshot. I mean, it's not even close. If you think about every important scientific discipline is brought to bear in the drug development process, materials, science, molecular biology, cellular biology, biology, every discipline of clinical medicine, the whole manufacturing process is very sophisticated, among the most sophisticated in the world. And that's very expensive. Almost all of these areas require advanced training and frequently postdoctoral training, and that's expensive. And then there's another component to that which people don't often talk about. Most people are familiar with sales and marketing and production in a normal company and how they're very different cultures. And sometimes they don't understand each other and sometimes they have very different expectations of the world. Well, think about this from this point of view. The management, the oversight of getting folks from such different disciplines to collaborate is not trivial. And it's one of the hidden costs of the complexity of the process itself.
John, how does the compensation for your researchers compare to other industries?
It depends on the...
You really have the best and brightest working in the industry.
Well, we'd like to believe we do, but of course that's probably not true. I mean, we pay competitively. So if you look at a molecular biologist who works at Pfizer, the way we calculate our pay for scientists is it's supposed to be competitive with the market. So if we have a material scientist, they'll make roughly the same as a material scientist at DuPont or Dow. If we have a clinician, then they'll make roughly the same as they would somewhere else doing a similar job. So when we start doing research, you don't go into a new area without a lot of thought. And so when we start working on something like Alzheimer's, we approach it from every different major hypothesis where we see promise. So when we have a program trying to treat Alzheimer's disease, we'll have many different compounds trying to explore many different hypotheses for the disease. So, for example, Alzheimer's was first described about 100 years ago by Dr. Alzheimer, not surprisingly, in France. And it wasn't until many years later that somebody actually did an autopsy on a patient with Alzheimer's and noticed the plaque, which now is the hallmark of Alzheimer's. And in fact, still to this day, it's very difficult to definitively diagnose Alzheimer's when a patient is still living, because that's really still remains the definitive diagnosis. But after we started to notice this plaque and tangle in the brain, we started to come up with a lot of hypotheses. Well, why could that be there? What could cause this? And that generates a number of different scientific hypotheses that that are tested. Some of those are tested in our labs. Some of them are tested at the labs at the National Institutes of Health. And I want to say something here about NIH, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the role of NIH is versus the role of pharma. NIH does almost no drug development. But that doesn't mean what they do isn't important. It's extremely important. They invest billions of dollars in basic research. And their research is often at this level. So what could cause Alzheimer's disease? And what does the data tell us? And how do we understand better what the mechanism of the disease is? But rarely does NIH actually ever work on a drug. And if they do work on a drug, usually they get it from us. So if you look at the patents that are filed, 95% of the patents that are filed for marketed products in this country come from private industry.
95%.
Now, and again, and it's really interesting to me, it's a little frustrating to me, because it seems like there's two poles on that point. One group saying industry does everything and NIH does nothing, and the other group says the opposite. And in fact, the NIH, the role of the NIH is critically important, and we support the expanded funding of the NIH, because it's very important for us. NIH trains scientists, that's very important. NIH understands new mechanisms of disease, that's very important. But they do precious little drug development. So if anybody thinks that we're going to get our drugs from NIH in the absence of a robust pharmaceutical company, there's just zero data to support that. Zero. So anyway,
you take many of your basic scientists from NIH.
We do. We hire from the NIH, and as I mentioned, that's a very important role that they play. So often, when somebody gets a PhD, they'll get a postdoctorate degree, and frequently they'll do those at the NIH. And that's very important. It's not to be underestimated. It's an extremely important thing that they do for the scientific infrastructure, and that's not true just for the drug industry. It's true for industry in general. NIH is critical to our preeminence in science in the world.
Could I ask a question then? Back in the early 70s, I was a research biologist and worked for University of Colorado Medical Center in their pharmacology department, and then also at University of Arizona in their microbiology pharmacology. And I was a research biologist, and I worked with mammalian cells. And somebody was sending us something that I was testing on epithelial cells, skin cells, heart cells, mm-hmm. all sorts. Could that have been? I didn't pay any attention. My job was I was a tech, and that all I had to do was just run tests.
Sure.
Do you do
collaborations yes.
like that? And
yeah, so absolutely, and it's one of the things that we do that we don't get much credit for, but we supply reagents and very important reagents to labs all over the world. And because one of the things that people at NIH are trying to do is publish. And one of the things that's really important for them to do to publish is to do interesting work and understanding, well, geez, we have a new class of drugs, statins. How do they work in, and they might be interested in a very academic and commercially non-viable question. And they may need access to a compound or an antibody, and we have a very ambitious program where we make that stuff available all the time. Because making this stuff is very, very expensive. Just a couple of kilos of material can cost millions and millions of dollars, and a small academic lab just can't afford that. So we supply a lot of that, and it wouldn't be surprising that the labs you work in, maybe not from Pfizer, but probably from some pharmaceutical company.
John, just a follow-up. On the NIH, do they do, like, foundational information and then you use that information
yes.
to take it one step further?
Absolutely right.
They save you from recreating the wheel.
Right. Well, typically we read about these things in the peer-reviewed journals. That's how the information is transferred. But that's exactly how it works. And so, for example, it's some of the seminal work in APOE4 was done at Duke University under NIH grants, and that's one of the most important hypotheses, or considered to be one of the most important hypotheses right now for the blocking of plaque formation. And if you can inhibit that, the production of APOE4, you may in fact be able to reduce Alzheimer's. That was work done under NIH grants at Duke University that was very important, and that's how the system works.
So, John, if I can just follow up on that, then. So how did they benefit? How does that university and NIH benefit when you go ahead and develop a drug from their research?
Well, it depends on, and they benefit because we develop a cure for, or a treatment, effective treatment for a disease. That's the principal benefit. And how they benefit financially, it depends on what their role is in the development process. So, I went to Columbia as an undergrad. Columbia last year made $180 million. On their intellectual property. It was money that they were paid because they played an important role in the development of a cancer drug.
And who paid that?
I believe Bristol-Myers
is making
royalty payments to Columbia because they played an important role. One of the insights that they developed during their scientific research was commercially important.
Was that part of a contract?
Yes. And so there's lots of universities. MIT is a very important program. They make hundreds of millions a year in royalties based on work that their professors have done that come back to the universities. I forget the total number, but it's probably over $1 billion. But I don't know. I don't know for a fact what it is. But it's a lot of money that goes back when those universities. It's rare, but it happens that the academic researchers make commercially important insights and discoveries, and in that case, they patent them, and they get paid royalties, and they can be many, many millions of dollars.
Thank you.
So this is a very busy slide, and I apologize for it up front, but this is what the development process looks like. So you start with the idea, that hypothesis, that's in the lower left-hand corner. And out of that, you develop a project operating plan, or POP, we call them at Pfizer. And this is a very detailed plan that says, okay, here's the hypothesis, here's the test, here's what success looks like, and here's what we will do if we're successful. Then you synthesize compounds. The reason these are roundabouts is because you spend most of the time developing going in circles. So the discovery phase takes 5 to 7 years, and that's after you start with an operating plan. So you say, this is the compound or class of compounds. This is the mechanism in this disease. Then you spend 5 to 7 years developing and synthesizing a whole family of compounds and testing those to see if they work. One of the most common tests is something called a receptor binding assay, in which case you've identified a receptor that's involved in the disease. You put the compound that you're interested in a 96-well plate, and you see, does it even bind to the receptor in the first place? Because if it doesn't bind to the receptor, then guess what? It's never going to be a medicine. But even if it does bind to the receptor, it doesn't mean it is a medicine. So you go through and we will do hundreds of thousands of compounds, and we'll screen them, and we will come up with hits. We'll come up with compounds that do bind the receptor. And the next question is, well, so what? So it bound the receptor. Maybe that causes something bad to happen. So you do a whole amount of additional research on what happens when the receptor is bound and what does that mean. Does it create a medicine or not? You spend 5 to 7 years. Once you finish with that, then you go into a very, very extensive series of safety studies. And typically in rodents, rats or mice. And you'll study this, and what happens? How is it cleared? So in a mammal, the liver does most of the clearance of stuff that's in the blood. So we'll look in the liver and see, is this stuff collecting? Is it causing any problems? And we'll do a lot of testing to make sure that it's safe. After it's safe, then it becomes what we call a candidate. So this is 6 to 9 years. We have a candidate. Now, Pfizer's a big company. We spend about $100 million on research every week. And we have about 40 of these a year. This is a huge success to have a candidate. Very, very difficult. Once it becomes a candidate, we'll develop the formulation. Now, this is not trivial. So there are there are some medicines out there that actually would probably work really well if you could make them. So they're not stable at room temperature. They're just too expensive. The manufacturing process is just too expensive. So a lot of time and money is spent making enough of the product to actually test. After that, we then go into an even more extensive safety process before beginning the going into people. That is, again, another huge, huge achievement. So we have many fewer first in person studies than we have candidates, and we lose about 50% of our candidates within 6 months after they are nominated as candidates, because we do the safety studies identify a problem. We then go into between 10 and 50 normal healthy people, and these are typically college students, but people who are paid to participate in the study, and they take the drug to make sure that in a normal healthy person it doesn't have any adverse effects. Based on safety, a good safety profile, which means no adverse events in those participants, then we go into, for the first time, patients with the disease. These are called phase 2 studies. And there's two things we're looking for in a phase 2 study. The first is we're looking for safety. And the second is we're looking for some kind of dose that would be appropriate to use in the pivotal study. So we'll do, and now the phase 2 studies are usually 1 to 300 patients, but we do many, many, many of those. So that can be thousands of people easily.
The phase 1 study, could you maybe elaborate on how that works? It says healthy volunteers. What's the process?
So basically, if you pick up a newspaper, particularly near a college campus, you'll see ads for recruiting people to participate in a study. Sometimes they want people who have a particular disease, but sometimes they're just looking for normal, healthy volunteers. And so basically, you show up. They'll give you what they think is a therapeutic dose of whatever the medicine they're trying to test, and then they'll take a blood sample and monitor, give you a full checkup, and make sure that there have been no adverse events. So that if you didn't get a cough or diarrhea or any side effects that could be attributed to the medicine.
So if you're healthy and you're getting a medication for a specific problem that you don't have, doesn't that have adverse? impacts on you?
Well, no. The point is, we're not trying to see if it works. We're just trying to make sure it's safe. So everything we do in this process, as I mentioned before, it's probably the most careful process human beings have ever invented. Everything we're doing is trying to ensure, number one, is it's safe. So the reason we go into healthy people first is because they're less vulnerable. And they have a strong immune system that's normal. Their livers are healthy and normal. That, you know, and we want to make darn sure before we go into sick people that we know as much as we can about the process itself and how the drug gets metabolized. We've already done, you know, decades of study on this compound beforehand, but until you go into people, you don't really know. Now, you have a pretty good idea because, you know, you've tested another mammalian species, so you know that, you know, how the drug gets cleared in a dog or how it gets cleared in a rat or a mouse. But humans are different, and you can never be 100% sure until you've tested it in humans. And the most conservative thing to do when you go into humans for the first time is to test it in healthy people, because they're the least likely to get sick from taking the medicine. And that's why you don't do a lot. You don't do a very large study, because you want to make sure that it's, again, it's safe. Does that answer your question? So then finally, you end up in what's called the phase 3 study, or the pivotal study. And out of the phase 2 study, you've gotten some indications of efficacy. So there's some programs that are killed in phase 2 because they appear not to work. But generally, the two preeminent things you've identified are A, what's that it's safe, and then B, some kind of dose. And then you go into a very large study, often 3,000 to 10,000 people, which is called the pivotal study. And then in the pivotal study, you have to prove that it works. And this is an interesting thing. I mean, there are a lot of medicines that have never been brought to market that work, but they don't work for everybody. And when you go into a 10,000 person population, the way the statistics are run, it has to be safe for everybody, to the best of your ability to identify that, number one. And then secondly, it has to work in most people. So it can work really well in a very small subset of the population, but not work generally for the rest of the people, and it doesn't work. That's a failure by definition. So when somebody says a drug has been proven safe and efficacious in a phase 3 trial, what that means is, for the entire population studied, it demonstrates an efficacy. Now that's not trivial. Because when you read about a 12 or 15% improvement, what that means is a 12 or 15% improvement across the entire population. But human beings, every one of us is different. And so for some of those patients, they didn't get much better at all. And a lot of them got much better. So when you read those statistics and somebody says, well, it's 12% better, you know, think about it. 10,000 people don't take medicine. We take medicine one person at a time, and it affects each of us one person at a time. So when you look at those results, you have to keep that in mind. And that's one of the reasons why we have such confidence in those outcomes, because the statistics are designed in a way where it's very, very difficult to show that something really works when it doesn't. I mean, so the idea one of the things that drives me crazy is you cannot turn the television on late at night without seeing ads for diet products. None of those products have been subjected to any of this rigorous analysis. None of them. And the ones that have been subjected to any analysis have been demonstrated, in almost all cases to my knowledge, to not work at all. And we're so consumed with direct-to-consumer advertising, and no one seems to be concerned about direct-to-consumer advertising for products that are provably not working, and where we spend tens of billions of dollars a year on. It's a very interesting dichotomy. And again, as I mentioned before, it's interesting to me, so much interest in direct-to-consumer advertising, which clearly has a public health benefit, and very little interest, except now recently from FDA, and looking at advertising for diet products.
It's interesting to read the labeling on a lot of the herbal products.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, what's amazing to me is some of the ads will tout the fact this is not a drug. You know, which essentially means this has never really been rigorously tested. But you know, it's just, again, that dichotomy, the difference in way that group of folks selling their product is treated. And I would argue the way that we're treated in terms of public opinion and the perception of many folks in the legislatures around the country, it really bothers us as scientists, because we look at it and it makes no sense to us. We look at the data that we bring forward, how clear it is, and how hard we work at uncovering faults. That's what clinical study is all about, finding the problems. The whole design of the infrastructure is designed to find the problems in our products. And we spend billions of dollars a year. You know, and one of the sayings in the industry is, you know, clinical compounds never get better. You never uncover, all of a sudden it gets better. They only get worse as you learn more and more and more about them. And that's the design. That's why we do the studies. It's specifically to identify things that aren't safe or are not efficacious. And it's a system that we should be proud of as Americans. It is the gold standard.
Is there going to be? I mean, you look at your phase three, and I'm wondering at this point if the mapping of the genome is going to change that dynamic, because something that may only be 15% effective may be 100% effective of somebody with a specific...
Great point. Okay. So I will get back to that.
Okay.
So then we go to registration, and then we are allowed to sell the product in the U.S. In Europe, we're not allowed to sell the product yet. We have to get it approved for reimbursement, and then we have to get a price for it. And that's why there's very little research being done in Europe these days, and less each passing month. The bottom line is the vast majority of compounds never make it. To your point earlier, we patent products. So you see in the bottom line, from idea to drug takes between 11 and 15 years. We will file a patent in the discovery area. Now, we file it as early as we can because we don't want to get scooped by somebody else, but we wait as long as possible because we want to get as much time on the market as we can. And the pressure on us to do that is enormous. But that gives you an idea. So under the best of circumstances, under the absolute best of circumstances, half of the patent life is gone by the time you make a penny on your drugs. Half. And under the worst of circumstances, sometimes you only have 2 or 3 years left. So that's one of the reasons why patents are so important to the industry.
I'm sorry, you went over a point that I think is very important, and you did it very fast. And what you said was that in Europe, the countries are negotiating their reimbursement rates with for the payment of pharmaceutical coverage
right
before they approve the drugs, which is very different than how we do it in this country.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's an important point. Maybe you could elaborate on.
Sure. Well, I mean, basically, the in most of the European countries, they decide what they're going to pay for new drugs. And again, if your objective is lower prices today, it works. If your objective is new drugs tomorrow, it doesn't work. And so what you've seen, I mean, so they used to call Europe the medicine cabinet of the world. Almost all of the innovative new medicines in the 50s and 60s were done in Basel and Switzerland and in France and Germany and the UK. There are none anymore. The lights in the laboratories are out. There's Novartis, which is a very large Swiss-based pharmaceutical company, its headquarters is in Basel. All of its R&D was done. It's moved its R&D. It's left its headquarters and moved it to Cambridge, Massachusetts, because the chilling effect of the continually degrading reimbursement levels in Europe. And I understand why, for you folks, when you look at your Medicaid drug budget and you say, man, this is a huge problem, I understand why that looks really attractive. And what I'm here to tell you today is it may be attractive over the short term, but over the long term it's a disaster. It's disinvesting in the most cost-effective mode of treatment for human disease.
So what I think I hear you saying is because European nations are dictating the price of new drugs coming onto the market, it has caused, in effect, a cessation of research happening.
That's correct.
That's what you said.
Yes.
Okay.
John, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to me that there used to be an extension after the primary patent period. Is there any opportunity to extend your patent if you're only 2 years from the loss of it?
Yeah, so this is very interesting. So there's been a lot of coverage of the Bristol-Myers case and of the Shearing-Plough case. And so to answer your question, yes, you can. So for example, a classic example is a cardiovascular drug that needed to be taken four times a day. And so somebody figured out a way to allow you to take it once a day with a controlled release formulation, and they patented the controlled release formulation. And they were, with that new innovation, they were able to extend the patent life for several more years. Now, other companies have tried to come up with patents that, so when you file a patent, it has to do three things. It needs to be useful, it needs to be new, and it needs to be non-obvious. Okay? And there's a very...
Non-obvious.
It can't be obvious to someone trained in the art, is the exact how it's defined.
Like changing the color of the pill.
Right. So there's a huge infrastructure of very talented people in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Patent and Trade Office that it's their job to figure that out. Now, a pharmaceutical company is perfectly, anybody can come up and say, listen, you know, this paper, it's new, I want to patent this. And guess what? Some of them try it. Because there's enormous pressure on companies to maintain their patent life. But it's the patent office's job to evaluate that. And if it isn't new, and if it's obvious, and if it's not useful, then guess what? It doesn't get an extension. And so this idea that somehow there's this massive manipulation of this system, I mean, those companies went through the appropriate regulatory and legal authorities with a case that this was, in fact, different than this. And guess what? They said no. So Taxol was rejected. The glucophage was rejected. So the fact is that you can file a lot of extensions, but you know 99% of the time, if they're not really important, they don't work. So there is no, in my opinion, excuse me, there is no systematic manipulation of the system to anyone's benefit. Because guess what? Everyone's trying to manipulate the system. That's what the system's there to evaluate new things and to figure out which ones deserve patents and which ones don't.
So, John, how many extensions are granted? What percentage?
Well, I don't know that. I can get that information for you, but I don't know off the top of my head. And it would really depend on what field you were looking in. And what compound and those statistics are going to be all over the place. Okay. So in some cases it's going to be 90% of them. In other cases it'll be 1%. There wouldn't be any generic answer across a lot of areas.
Okay.
So, thank you. So R&D is really difficult, and it's particularly difficult when we're concerned about sustaining these programs. When we go into a new area, Pfizer has been doing research in oncology for 18 years. We still don't have a marketed product. And when you make that investment in a new an oncology program, you're not thinking about tomorrow. You're thinking about 10, 20, 30 years from now. And when we make those investments, the people who control that money have to be responsible. And they have to say to themselves, all right, what's it look like 10 years down the road? And even if we develop a fantastic new medicine, is it going to matter? Or are we going to go the way of price controls where somebody dictates what the return is going to be? And that's the conundrum we're in. At the time when we have the most promise, we have the most opportunity, there's the most uncertainty around, you know, is there a benefit? Not tomorrow, but what's it look like? What's the reimbursement look like 10, 15, 20 years from now? So I want to just talk about three things very quickly that are a big threat to R&D investment. The first is exclusivity. The second is the actual returns on marketed medicines. And then finally is what's happening with generics. So, again, you know, and this is, again, the public debate around this is again, I think, very, very misleading. People talk about patents as if they confer exclusivity, and they do, only for that compound. So if you look at a specific compound, yes, no one else can copy that, at least not legally, as long as it's patented in the country you're selling it in. But they are perfectly free to make a very similar compound that has a similar uses the same mechanism of action, works in a similar way, has a similar side effect profile. And what you see is 30 years ago, you had a lot of practical exclusivity. So in other words, there would be no additional class of drug. Excuse me, not an additional drug in the same class for 10, 12 years. Look at what happened to Celebrex and Vioxx. So Celebrex was introduced and Vioxx was introduced 3 months later. Now, is that a bad thing? No. It's a great thing. It's better for the public health because you give the doctor an alternative because, as I said earlier, not everyone, we're all different and we all react differently to medicines. So it's good to have a therapeutic alternative from a safety point of view and from a clinical point of view. Secondly, it's good to have a second alternative from a cost point of view because guess what? The second drug is always cheaper than the first. So this is a good thing for the social contract. It's just not good for the innovator because they can't get as much money for that product for as long as they could previously. And so this is the point about patents. Patents do not confer exclusivity in an area. They confer only exclusivity for the compound. And again, this is not necessarily bad as long as the companies that are making those innovative new products still have the money to do so. Then this works great.
How is it that a product that takes so long to get to market could have the coincidence that Celebrex and Vioxx would come out within 3 months of each other?
Yeah, it's a good question. So,
of where the industry is going to, you know, deal with arthritis.
So usually how it happens, it really depends on the therapeutic area. So in this case, these are called COX-2 inhibitors, and there was some very, very important work done, again, at NIH and in industry, looking that discovered this novel pathway. And then a number of companies, once that was discovered, a number of companies developed compounds around that mechanism of disease. And it was really a coincidence. Vioxx could easily have been on the market before Celebrex, or, you know, it was they were neck and neck. And see, one of the things you don't know is any one of those compounds, as we saw earlier, could have died in development. In fact, many, many, many did. So, you know, it's very difficult to predict who is going to come on the market and when, or if they're going to come on the market at all. It's the regulatory process is really tough. There's a lot of attrition, and basically a lot of companies are working, especially in big areas like arthritis and cardiovascular disease, working on similar mechanisms. But you don't know who's going to make it, and you do know that not everyone will make it, and it's very difficult to pick who's going to get on the market first. And then even when they do get on the market first, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the best drug. And we see that over and over again. And then some products get on the market and have to be withdrawn because we discover safety effects even post-marketing. So you want to have several products for a lot of different reasons, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So this is a slide that most people, it's an amazing slide. What it shows is because the cost of developing new products is so expensive, most marketed products don't make money. In other words, they don't return the invested capital to make them in the first place. And that's because it's costing nearly $1 billion now to bring a drug to market. And most medicines don't have that kind of market. So when somebody asks me, you know, how do you defend, you know, Lipitor's going to be the first $10 billion a year drug, you absolutely have to have a Lipitor, and you need preferably a couple of them. Because Lipitor pays for not only all the failed lipid-lowering products in development, not only all the failed other products in development that are never going to go anywhere, but they're also subsidizing the development of marketed medicines. And if you don't have one or two or three of these, you won't survive. So if you look at companies that get acquired, it's because they don't have any of those in the first column. And because essentially those big marketed products for these huge populations are subsidizing the development of drugs for across the rest of the pharmacopoeia.
This is 13 years old. Sorry, this is 13 years old.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
Has it changed since 13?
So actually, thank you. That's I usually. It's actually the study has been done again, and the new data is it still hasn't been published. I don't understand. I saw it at a conference, and it still hasn't been published, and it should be any day now. And actually, it was done by the same people, Grabowski and Vernon. They're from Duke, and what they showed was now it's 2 in 10, the updated version, which is not surprising because because you see here, this was done when it only cost $200 million to develop a new drug, and now it's $800 million.
When you say 2 in 10, what do you mean?
So two of 10 today make money, whereas 3 in 10 used to make money.
Thank you.
Because the cost has gone up a lot, and the revenue has gone up a lot on the first two. So they've kept up with the cost increases. The other ones are still way down. So there are lots of really important drugs that if you made a decision, if the company had one drug and it knew what it was going to take to invest, it would never develop the drug because it would not get the invested capital back. And if you think about that, again, you start talking about, well, let's see, we're going to nationalize this industry, or we're going to figure out how to do only one. You know, it's not possible. Because you can't know until you get the drug on the market whether it's going to get on the market, and you don't know what its safety profile and its efficacy profile is going to be until you've already spent your $800 million. So it's very difficult to plan that.
But aren't you worried that you're going to price yourself out of business? I'm so worried about so many patients who are now taking their pill every other day, or you know, dividing their pills in half, and some have even stopped because they can't afford them. And I know it's a supply and demand, but pretty soon the demand. I'm nervous that
we are extremely worried about that, and that's one of the reasons why we have such an ambitious free medicine program, because we feel very strongly about that. But this is another dichotomy. Have you ever heard anybody complain about the cost of a hip replacement? Ever? Not once. How about an MRI? Not once.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there
are. Oh, that's the other first folks that I've heard that back from.
Yeah.
But you look at a hip replacement, that costs $48,000. And the reason people don't complain about it is because it's covered. This is a coverage problem, not a cost problem. And I'll show you some data on that. I mean, that's why people are so focused on us. It's really simple. It's the coverage. I mean, so Medicare didn't have a prescription drug benefit in 1967, and so people are upset because they have to pay out of their pocket. I don't blame them. But they're not complaining. It's not that they're not complaining about hip replacements because they're so cheap. You see what I mean? It works both ways. Hip replacements are very expensive. And the reason why people aren't complaining about them is because they're covered. It's as simple as that. But I agree with you. Coverage is a huge problem, and it's something we're really concerned about. That's why we introduced some of the programs that we have to try to make drugs more readily accessible. You don't seem satisfied with that answer.
Oh, no, it's just a problem.
No, I agree with you. It's the problem.
And that's on everyone's mind.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. So, and then just the last point about generic substitution. So it used to be when a product went generic, that the generic company would start to sell, but the branded product would continue to sell pretty much at its same level. It usually would stop growing, and then it would gradually decline as doctors got more and more experience with the generic. And that was because, for obvious reasons, the doctor was more comfortable with it. It was, you know, he knew what the compound was. He knew how his patient dealt with it. And even though it's the same product, the buffers might be a little different, and they just wanted to be careful. Well, that's no longer a luxury they can afford. So day one, they switched to generics because they have to. So if you look at here, in 30 days, 80% of their market was gone. Now, again, as I said about the Vioxx as a competitor to Celebrex, that's not a bad thing for us as a society. This is great. Generics are wonderful. Pfizer's really proud of all the products we invented that other people make money off of now. We really are. And they make a huge improvement in healthcare. The only thing you have to make sure is that you don't go too far in this direction. So as long as you're able to maintain the goose that lays the golden eggs, the new products that the generics will sell when they go off patent, then the system works.
But right, can't you make generics too and compete with them?
We do.
We can, and we do. Well, actually, Pfizer doesn't, but some companies do. And generally speaking, it's a different business you're in. So if you think about Merck and Medco, so Merck is a $60 billion a year company. $30 billion of that is drugs, and $30 billion of that is Medco. The margins in the Medco business, I think, are 4%. you can't sustain investing. You know, they can't make 4% profit and invest 17% in R&D. They can't.
Medco's the generic.
It was the PBM? It's a PBM. It's actually it's a pharmacy benefits manager. So they it's just a very different business that they're in, and it doesn't make enough money to invest in R&D. So that's one of the reasons why they're spinning it off. So yes, it's just a different kind of business. See, the generic companies, they don't have any R&D. They don't. It costs them nothing to make the product. They get our patent, they read it, and then here's what's really amazing. They use our data to get it approved. They go and they take our dossier that we spent hundreds of millions of dollars developing, and they submit it to FDA to show that this drug is safe. And that's all fine. That's how the rules work.
But common sense to me would say, okay, I've got it. Patent's out. Someone else is going to take this. I'm going to get the market share by just, you know, making it, you know, selling
it. And again, it just comes down to what business are you in. If we go into that business, we won't be able to invest as much in the new medicines because we don't make as much on those products.
But you couldn't do both. I mean, you can't.
Well, some companies have tried, and the experience is mixed. Some companies, and I'm not an expert on this, so I don't want to get pressed too hard on it. But I'm familiar with some companies that have made a good business out of it, and I'm familiar with other companies that have tried it and then gotten out of it. And I don't, you know, but I think the reason why is, if you want to continue to innovate, you need the money, and it's really expensive, and it doesn't. Generics companies don't generate enough profit to make new medicines, and they don't need to because they're not in that business. They're just in the business of taking innovators' products and making and manufacturing them. They don't do any research. Zero.
Yeah, I know that.
Well, it's a matter of whether these two business models fit together or not.
Right.
More than anything.
Well, and again, they do. And again, as I say it, I mean this. This is generic substitution is a good thing for the public health. It provides cheaper drugs to more people, and that's a good thing. The only thing we need to make sure is that there are new drugs to genericize. And as long as that system works, then that's fine. So a lot of this pressure on the industry, and here's what I think that we need to be concerned about. This is a list of the PMA, the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers of America. It was the industry group before pharma. This was a list of the folks in 1988. That's today. Look at that. I mean, that's not a good thing.
And the last two are...
That's right. That's right. So, Shearing Plows, you know, had some trouble. Bristol-Myers troubles have been well documented. Pharmacia will shortly be joining Pfizer.
How much of that dynamic is driven by tort?
You know, I don't even have an opinion on that. I really don't know.
Okay.
I mean, tort is a real issue. The thing that drives these mergers is the inability to continue to sustain the investment for 20 years down the line. And again, as I said before, when you make that investment, when you start a new program, you're not saying, okay, we're going to make a quick hit, and in 18 months we'll be able to turn this. You're saying, okay, here's $5 billion, and where am I going to put this? And if I put it into research, I've got to be willing and able to know that it's going to pay dividends down the road, way down the road. So if you look at these companies, Pharmacia made a lot of money last year. It was acquired because it couldn't make enough money to sustain its survival. And this is the thing that's interesting. So
this is mostly economies of scale then.
It is, but it's also brutal competition and
okay.
And survival of the fittest around innovation. This profits thing really, it's very interesting to me. It's another example where people say things that, you know, maybe you can help me understand this. So, just take this from 1980 to date, and everybody talks about how the pharmaceutical industry is the most profitable, and that is again A, that's just bad by definition, and then B, that means that I presume that what that means is a pharmaceutical industry is doing really well and it's easy to make money. I mean, you know, is that a fair That's what I read when I read the stuff in the newspapers. Let me ask you a question. How many new companies have come into our business in the last 25 years? Now, if this was so easy, if there was just scads of money lying around on the floor and we just come in and pick it up, don't you think that General Electric, who's the most diversified, you know, most talented management in the world, they made $12 billion in profits 2 years ago. Don't you think they'd take a billion or two or three and invest it in the medicines market if it were so easy to make money? Zero people. Now, doesn't that tell you something?
Is that really true? Are you talking about pharma members? I mean, I own stock in a pharmaceutical company that isn't on your list. I mean, I find
it's really true.
Particularly with genomics and all these companies coming and doing genetic research and applying that to prescription drugs.
Okay, so you were talking about biotechnology companies, right?
Sure.
Okay, so.
But not the one I own stock in. That's just maybe not a pharma member for whatever reason.
I'm talking about companies that make small molecule drugs for big markets. That's how I define this. Now, if you want to throw biotech in there.
You have filtered then small run pharmaceutical companies. So the zero number isn't exactly true unless you're talking about home runs like Lipitor.
So let me answer your question thoroughly because it's a very important one. So I spent 10 years in the biotech industry. And the last time I looked, there were about 3,000 biotech companies in the U.S. There are about 1,200 publicly traded biotech companies in the U.S. And there were four that had ever turned a quarterly profit. Four. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't innovation going on in those companies. There is no commercially validated innovation with the exception of three products, two of which were discovered and co-developed with major pharmaceutical companies. So Amgen and Genentech are clear, successful companies. They're based on a different technology. Those are not small molecule drugs. They're basically large molecules, proteins, erythropoietin, human growth hormone, a couple other. A very different business model and a very different market. So most of the biotech products cost upwards of $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 per administration. Much more narrowly niched, and many, by orders of magnitude, fewer people being treated. So if you look at any standard definition of industry, if you look at either the technology base or the market base, most economists would say that they're different kinds of companies. But even if you include that, so let's throw Amgen and Genentech in there because they're real companies and they've made, you know, done very, very well. The thousands of other biotech companies that have never developed a product and probably never will, except in collaboration with some of the bigger companies, that's a much clearer picture of what the industry looks like. And to my point, if you're talking about companies that research, develop, test, this is the list, and I absolutely stand by what I said. Johnson & Johnson did most of the clinical trials for erythropoietin in collaboration with Amgen. So Amgen discovered the molecule, and this doesn't mean that what they're doing isn't important. What it means is the scale of clinical and regulatory infrastructure required to bring a medicine to market is just beyond the scope of almost any biotechnology company. There are three or four that can afford to do this. And the reason why is it's so bloody difficult. That's why General Electric isn't saying, hey, look at that, that's a great market, let's jump in there. Let's put $5 billion at risk because, you know, there's a lot of money to be made. And it's exactly the same reason. It cannot attract the sufficient capital to take those risks. And guess what? That's why the return has to be high. Because if it's not, no one will take those risks. And, you know, I've yet to run into anybody, an economist or any thoughtful person who's looked at this and has explained to me why no one else is getting into our business if it's so profitable. And the reason is, given the risks, it's not profitable enough. And that's why you're seeing that kind of consolidation. And again, why do we care? Getting back to your issue, the only reason we care is because we need new medicines, and we need innovative medicines, and we need great medicines. And this is the only system that we've been able to develop that produces those. Other than that, if it's just about what's good for the industry, who cares? But I would suggest that this is the only leverage we've got, because the demand for health care is going up, not arithmetically, but exponentially.
But you could also look at it as that these companies that are surviving, you're looking at trying to get the greatest amount of market share as you can, and some companies are better than others, and so consolidation is going to happen.
That's right, and I wouldn't say that every company, that every one of these mergers and acquisitions was a result of the issues that I'm raising. And I think your point's very well taken. There's some natural consolidation that happens. It's happened in banking. It's happened in other industries, and I think some of that is normal. I think the pressure on the industry right now, though, is quite unprecedented and is driving consolidation that is not necessarily good for the state of innovation. But I think your point's very well taken.
Do all of the developers of drugs belong to pharma?
Most of them. So there are a couple that aren't on there, but no really big international players. To Representative Dalto's point, there are companies that aren't in pharma that are pharmaceutical companies. In Europe, there are a number of sort of medium-sized pharmaceutical companies that are not on this list.
What proportion belong to pharma?
In terms of sales, it's probably well over 90%. I don't know the number off the top of my head. Is it somebody from pharma here? It's a very high percentage, but we can get the data for you. But it's pretty representative. I mean, working from the research environment, I would pledge to you that everything you've seen today is accurate as I can possibly make it. I'm not saying it's necessarily true or you should agree with it, but it's completely accurate to the best of my ability to make it so. I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about benefits. And I want to get back to the question that Representative Anderson raises about coverage, because I really think that that's the bottom line. First of all, I think, particularly in the developed nations, we take a lot of the innovation for granted. And I just cite one statistic that really amazes me. If you look at the mortality from tuberculosis from 1920, and you just fast forward to the population of 2000, or 2000, that's 300,000 people dying a year. And I think a lot of this we just take for granted. It's just sort of, yeah. And frequently when I show this slide, somebody says, yeah, well, that's old, and that's because of vaccines and antibiotics, and what have you done for us lately? So, fair question. So just since 1965, and look at these disease areas. These are very large, very important disease areas. You see a reduction in mortality from atherosclerosis of 74%. That's remarkable. A reduction in mortality from ulcers. I mean, we've almost eliminated ulcers. A huge medical problem because of several different pharmaceutical products. Ischemic heart disease, emphysema, hypertension, significant inroads into very large, very important diseases. And a lot of these are a function of better and more sophisticated and more technological innovation. Not necessarily all drugs. Some of the biggest improvements in managing heart disease are surgical interventions. But I wouldn't say it's X percent, but certainly drugs play a very important role in this process. But here's a really interesting statistic. And what I find interesting about this is the inflection point. Number of people 100 years or older in the population declined from 1900 to almost 1960. And then you look at what happened when we passed Medicare. And the point here is, and this is the point, you remember Thomas Malthus, the British economist from the 18th century? So he predicted that the world was going to starve to death because we were overpopulating too quickly, and he was proposing that families, actually poor families, be restricted to only one child because he was so concerned about overpopulation, particularly of poor people. And of course now we all laugh at him because of course there were about a billion people on the planet when he made his dire predictions of not being able to support this growth. But the reason why he wasn't wrong was not obvious at the time. The reason he was wrong is because of technology. So if you think about our ability to feed ourselves, in 1913 in this country, about 30% of the population was involved in growing food. Guess what it is now?
Less than
2%. But even adjusted for inflation, cheap food is cheaper now and it's better. And what's the solution? It's technology. And we have the same problem with healthcare. When we start tinkering around the edges, we look at marginal changes. Let's see, how do we dampen demand here? How do we make it harder for docs to write for Lipitor here? How do we, you know, close the formulary? All that stuff is tinkering around the edges around demand. And you're never going to stop people from seeking better healthcare. Because as long as they're eating and they're clothed and sheltered, that's their number one priority. So the only solution is technology. And I'll give you a really good example of the technology. If you look at HIV, in 1996, the first protease inhibitors were introduced to the market. In less than 2 years, mortality from HIV in the U.S. went down by 80%. 80%. That's amazing. But what's even more amazing is the number of hospitalization days to treat HIV went down by 40%. Cheaper and better. And when you look at those kinds of changes, we look at those kind of geometric increases in demand, which we're all facing as people get older and as we continue to demand more and better health care. Any kind of dampening of demand is like shoveling sand against the tide. The only way to solve this are approaches like the protease inhibitors, where you get much better medical outcomes and it's cheaper. And let me tell you, the best investment there, you know, really is in pharmaceuticals. Because those are the only tools that's the only leverage we have in the system. The other solution is labor intensive, capital intensive, build more hospitals, hire more doctors, and there's just no leverage there. And if you look at this as a technology, what we're seeing, and people are bemoaning the fact that we're spending a larger percentage of our budget on drugs. Well, the reason we're doing that is because we get better medical outcomes for less cost. You prevent hospitalization, you prevent surgeries, and yeah, you spend more money on drugs. That's not a bad thing. But we've somehow, you know, because we've demonized the industry, and because there really is incredibly real pressure on budgets, and because we've siloed the system so that we've got a drug budget here, we've got a doc budget here, we've got a hospital budget here, that we're not managing across those silos, we've created the solution to the healthcare problem, at least in the public debate, is, well, let's just pay less for our medicines. But, you know, I think that's very, very short-sighted. And from where we sit, we see an incredible opportunity. There's two more points I want to make, and then the first is something I referred to earlier about Me Too products. So, and I hear this all the time. You know, and if you've ever worked if you've ever spent 5 years on a trying to develop a drug, and then you hear somebody talk about how all these drugs are the same, it's hard to take. So let me just give you an example. So small technical differences can have enormous clinical value. So streptokinase versus TPA for heart attack. So streptokinase costs about, I don't know, $30 per administration. TPA is a biotech drug from Genentech, and it costs about $3,500 per administration. And the difference in the big study was a 12% difference. So that doesn't sound like much. So you say, wait a second, $3,500, you know. But you got to understand again, you know, these people aren't statistics. What that means is you die or you don't die. So if you want to play dice with your outcome in the ER, if you talk to an emergency room doc and tell them, look, it's really not that big a difference, you'll get a very different point of view. It's a very, very different medical outcome. And when you're talking about, you know, something like heart attacks, which is an emergent situation where people can die, well, the value of that is not trivial. Another example is the inhaled insulin versus injectable insulin. So some people would say, well, listen, it's the same, it's insulin. What's the big deal? There's no innovation there. Well, we spent 80 years trying to figure out a better way to deliver insulin rather than through a needle. And we're finally getting there. And there are a couple of products that are in very, very late development. Hopefully we'll be in registration soon for an oral formulation, basically an inhaled insulin. Now, some people would say that's not an innovation. Well, innovation is a better outcome. When you look at the big problem with insulin delivery, it's compliance. Diabetics don't take their insulin because they don't want to inject themselves in front of 50 people at a cocktail party. They don't want to go into the bathroom at a fast food restaurant and inject themselves. So they don't do it. So they end up with a lot of the sequela of diabetes, which is very expensive to treat. So with inhaled insulin, you get much better compliance. Much better compliance translates directly into much better health outcomes. But some people would argue this, and it's just insulin. And you know, and that's not only do that, they're doing that right now. That debate's raging at FDA right now. Topical antibiotics versus Zithromax. So, and again, I apologize for being so Pfizer-centric. There's a disease called trachoma, which is it's blindness caused by serial infections of the eye, and there's a pretty effective treatment for it. If you can use a topical antibiotic, you can use something like erythromycin. And unfortunately, in order to treat with erythromycin, you have to do it the eye wash several times a day for several months. In many countries in the world, there just isn't that kind of infrastructure to support that. So we developed Zithromax. And it turned out that Zithromax, one pill, and it's gone. So we've reduced blindness by 75% in Morocco in collaboration with the government. Now, some people will tell you, well, it's just another antibiotic. What's the value in that? It doesn't, you know, sure, it treats middle ear infections a little bit better, a little bit worse than another antibiotic. Well, again, it's not a small difference. The fact that you can take one pill once versus, you know, several times a day. The fact that you can do this for many pediatric illnesses for 2 or 3 or 4 days rather than 14 days for some of the older antibiotics, that's an important innovation. And these are the kinds of things that when somebody says, okay, we're gonna pick one drug. Any of you familiar with people that have suffered from depression? How many drugs did they rotate through? How many of them hit the right drug the first time? None of the people I know. And so we're going to be in a position where we say, and it'll be you guys that say this. Okay, it's Zoloft, or it's, you know, and then what are you saying to all those other people that don't respond to Zoloft for whatever reason? What are you saying to them? You're saying to them, get lost. So when somebody talks about this Me Too drug, it drives me crazy. There's no such thing as a Me Too drug, because if there isn't a demand out there, doctors won't write prescriptions for it. And every drug that's out there, there's a demand for it, or else it wouldn't be there.
You create that demand very often. You create that demand by your advertising, by your promotions to physicians.
You really believe that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, I do.
So, I mean, we've studied that a lot, and there's just no evidence to support that.
I can't believe that.
Well, let me just give you an example.
Physicians who say that people come in and ask them for Celebrex or whatever, that they advertise these beautiful full-page ads in the newspaper and in magazines, and that they see on television somebody happily running through a field saying, I want to be like that. And so they ask for that drug.
Right, and do they write prescriptions for it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, then they should, you know, then they should be in trouble because they shouldn't do that. But let me just ask you a question.
Why would you advertise if you didn't expect that people would be doing that and doctors wouldn't write the prescriptions?
I'll tell you why we advertise. Because for many of the products that we advertise, so think about this. You know, so your argument is, let's just take a step back. So your argument is there are lots of people out there who are taking drugs that shouldn't be on drugs. Is that your argument?
You had said that there is a demand for these, and so physicians should respond to that. I'm saying that you are creating the demand through your advertising. You would not spend those billions of dollars in advertising if you didn't think that demand was going to be created.
Right. So I think there are two assumptions underlying that statement, and you're saying it accurately, I think. I'm just trying to make sure I understand it. So the first one is that there are people out there, there are lots of people out there who are taking drugs like Celebrex that shouldn't be on Celebrex. Is that what you think?
I don't know. Would be another drug.
Right, that might be as effective. So that's one assertion, and I just want to sort of lay this out. The second one, this is the really important one from my perspective, is that there are not a lot of people out there that shouldn't be on drug. Do you see what I'm saying? So when you do when you send out a message to over the airwaves, it goes to whoever watches TV. It's a lot of people. So there are two things that you can think about those people. There are people out there who are taking this drug because of all the reasons you're saying, because they see Celebrex, they see somebody dancing, and they want to dance. And they go in and they ask their doctor.
Why would a doctor write a prescription for somebody that says they want to dance? I mean,
well, they shouldn't.
That's
right. You're absolutely right. But I want to get to the flip side of that is a much more powerful one for me. And that is, take Viagra. So people complain about Viagra. Even 3 years later, it's hard to not have you laughing about Viagra, but it's an important product. But Viagra, the reason people don't take Viagra is because they're embarrassed about it. And the reason they don't seek medical treatment is because they're embarrassed by it. Only 30% of the people in America, according to our numbers, that should be on Viagra are. So if we go out and advertise and we have big hunky guys that drive, you know, sports cars and baseball players and so forth that make it easier and okay for men to seek treatment for erectile dysfunction, that's a good thing. Now, are there people that are going to go in and seek Viagra because they don't need it? Of course there will be. And we expect the doctors to say no. But I would argue, and the data support this, there are a lot more people in the other category. So hyperlipidemia, it's an endemic. It's a huge problem in this country. There are lots of people that should be on statins that are not. And are there a lot of statin ads on TV? Yeah, there are, and that's a good thing. And I hope more people will go seek treatment for hyperlipidemia than do now. Because guess what? That'll save us money, too. Because if you catch that early and treat it with drugs, those people have fewer heart attacks, and they save the system money. So you have to look at both sides of that equation. Does direct-to-consumer advertising stimulate additional demand that's unnecessary? I'm sure it does. But that the number of those people pales in comparison to the number of people that should be on drug that are not. And that's a public health issue. And the data are just absolutely clear on this. There are very, very few of those medicines that are aggressively promoted where the level of treatment is even close to adequate in this country. And to say we should stop doing that because a few people are inappropriately seeking medicines and a few doctors inappropriately writing scripts, that doesn't make any sense from a public policy point of view. What about all those people that don't know about hyperlipidemia? There are a lot more of them. So, and I think the data on that are real clear. And I'd be happy, we have a book on that, which I'd be happy to send you, which I think is pretty compelling. It's got a lot of this data in it. And it really boils down to, who are we advertising to?
Good question.
And I think that we're advertising to everybody. And different people are going to behave differently. And on balance, I would argue DTC is absolutely good for the public health. And, you know, look at AMA. AMA is not opposed to direct-to-consumer advertising. Some doctors are, yeah. My wife is a family practice doc, and she gets patients that come in and tell her they want, and she says, no, you don't need it. Here's another drug that's cheaper that works just as well.
Hey, so John, just reflecting on since pharmaceutical companies have been allowed to advertise, I think like 1990, the restriction was lifted. I think maybe I've read one or two pharmaceutical like drug advertisements in magazines, and the second one was on a plane coming back to Oregon from a health policy forum, and I read it because I was just curious what those warnings were, and I was wondering what it was. So that's the only reason why I read it. I mean, I haven't been on a drug in years and years. I haven't been on a drug in years and years and years. But you know, I'm not running to my doctor, you know, seeking drugs because I've seen umpteen advertisements. I'm just reflecting on my personal experience, and I can tell you something as a related sort of a corollary. I went to my my primary care physician when I twisted my ankle severely while playing a game and wanting to get a referral to a podiatrist friend of mine who said he could solve the problem. My doctor would not give me a referral because he says, listen, there's nothing that guy can do that I can't do. So the doctor is deciding what the best course of treatment. What do you want me to do? He said.
Right.
You want me to give? And I don't want to fuck my doctor because I trust him. That's where I go to him. But you know, if the doctor doesn't think that a prescription is going to work for me, he's probably not going to write me the script.
Right.
Which is what my perspective
right.
is.
And that doesn't mean that people aren't going to ask inappropriately. And again, the trade-off, though, is, yes, there will be people that are going to inappropriately seek Viagra and Lipitor, but then there are going to be a lot more people that are going to appropriately seek that. And again, we're communicating the same message to both of them. The last thing I'll say on that is, does it bother you? Do the diet ads bother you at all?
Yes.
Okay, so because I mean, to me that you know when I see those and I hear this DTC debate, and I think 70% of Americans that should be on Viagra or not, and people are unhappy about us telling them about this product and making it okay for them to seek treatment for an embarrassing thing. I throw my hands up and I say, wait a second, where is the logic?
But I read a report along those same lines, and you make a very good point, very good argument, but that somebody will go in for Lipitor or whatever. I don't even know what that is, but if I go into a doctor for whatever those medicines I'm seeing advertised, and I wait a half hour in the waiting room, and then I'm 15 minutes in my underwear, and he comes in running in, and he's ready to run back out, and I say, Lipitor is the answer for me, and it's one that would work. He's not going to argue with me. I mean, you know, if it's an appropriate medicine, and yeah, a generic might be appropriate too, but he's not going to say, well, wait a minute. I don't think. I mean, they're going to say sure.
Yeah, you know, and I think that again, I look at those things, and on the margins, I think you're probably right. But again, you know, first of all, I hope he's going to test your cholesterol.
Yeah, I'm not.
You know, and you know, and honestly, I mean, so they'll run a lab test, and then you know, and you know, one of the things that's really interesting when we looked at Viagra, we looked at the app because we got such criticism on this, and one of the things we found was really interesting. 30% of the patients seeking treatment for erectile dysfunction were diabetics. They didn't need Viagra at all. They needed insulin. Mm-hmm. Now think about how important that was. So what are we doing? What does all direct-to-consumer advertising do? It drives people to see doctors. And that's not a bad thing. Think about all those diabetics that got diagnosed, and presumably, perhaps not all of them are compliant, but certainly more than zero are compliant. We're going to, again, save money. Much better health outcome, and that's an unintended effect of the direct-to-consumer advertising. We weren't planning on doing that when we did the advertising, but when you add up all the pluses and minuses of DTC, to me, it's just, you know, in addition to the First Amendment issues, which I think are important. Please.
You know, that just gets my juices flowing a little bit, because in practicing dentistry for 38 years, I can't ever remember a patient coming and saying, I want this drug.
Yeah.
A little different than medicine, but not much. They'd come and say, do I need an antibiotic?
Right.
They wouldn't say,
right,
hey, I need erythromycin. Right.
That's not advertised like these others are. I mean, and they have they're making very good arguments for the direct. I mean, I'm not arguing about that, but there is something.
I think you'll find different physicians respond differently, because I had a similar situation, yeah. Representative Barker, where I went to see my physician, and I happened to have a little bias, so I asked for a Pfizer drug, and he looked at me and said, really, Russ, well, which medical school did you graduate from? And that was the end of that discussion. And as it turned out, he did not prescribe a Pfizer medication for me. So it's, you'll see different responses.
I have a doctor will only prescribe brand name. He doesn't like it here.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, and mostly it's based on, you know, and this is where, I mean, medical, you know, the practice of medicine is an art, not a science. And you can't, or it's as much an art as a science, and you can't get in the way, you know, you can't tell that doctor, look, some doctors have, and this is really true of the SSRI drugs, the depression drugs, they have a deep experience with this, with patients that they know better than we'll ever know them, and they know their patients better than we do. And if they say Zoloft, then guess what? Who are we to say no? It should be Paxil. And I think we need to defer to the people who are on the front lines and who have the clinical expertise and have the relationship with those patients. And again, you know, it comes back to, well, do those doctors write for a particular drug because they've been visited by, you know, gotten a free pen? maybe some of them, but I, you know, not very many. You know, and again, compared
why
to...
Why would you do it, John?
What's that?
Why would you do it? Why would you give him the free pen or give him the free trip or give him the other promotion? You didn't expect that they're going to be writing out prescriptions.
Because it keeps us in their minds. And it keeps... So you have a Paxil tab thing on your desk. It reminds you of Paxil. But it doesn't change the clinical profile of Paxil. And it doesn't change the safety profile of Paxil. And it doesn't make Paxil work in a case, and, you know, in a patient that it didn't before. And so you just have to, so, you know, you look at the sales and promotion. It's again, you have to think about that in another business.
Well,
so of course we promote our...
So if Fords are being advertised, you think that Ford thinks, oh, this is really wonderful. People need cars, so they'll go somewhere to look for a car. And it doesn't matter if it's Fords. And that's sort of what I'm hearing you saying. It doesn't matter that they're going to be the fellow who went in for Viagra. So it didn't matter. The wonderful thing was that he found out he was diabetic. You wouldn't advertise Viagra just because you want somebody to find out they're diabetic.
No, of course. I said that. I said, look, that wasn't our intention at all, and I agree with you. But you have to look at what's the impact and what's the impact on everybody. And that's all I'm saying. And I'm look, we advertise because we think we'll sell more stuff because we advertise. We promote our products because we want to sell more stuff.
Got it.
There's no question about that. I would never dispute that for one second. And the difference between us and Ford, however, is there's a third party that decides. It's not directly to the consumer. They have to go to somebody who's been very, very highly trained, that knows this patient, and they get to decide.
And the other thing I hear you saying is that you may have a very short window that you've got to make that research and development come back.
Right.
Or you don't have the money to go to the next drug down the line.
And that's a big reason why we aggressively promote things, because, man, we've got to... I mean, one of the things that we have to do is we need to get that to as many people as we can, as quickly as we can, because the patent clock's ticking.
I guess I just have trouble with you sort of implying that the advertising is wonderful because it gets people to doctors. If you're saying you're advertising because you need to sell your product so that you can go out and do more research and development.
Right.
I can understand that.
No, that's right. And again, and those other points that I make, I think they're true, but they're not the intent. And I agree. And I mentioned that earlier. It's not our intent to drive patients to get treated for diabetes with our Viagra. It just happens to be an unintended but very positive side effect. But that's not what we're trying to do. That's fair.
Hey, John, I've got a problem with the implication that it's just a pen and a pad that says, you know, Viagra or whatever, Paxil on it. Because, you know, what's your industry term for you know, the road shows, the physicians, and all that kind of stuff.
Detailing.
Okay, detailing is the term. So, compare detailing, the amount of detailing, to the amount of direct-to-consumer advertising. What is that comparison? It's probably two to one, isn't it?
It's probably even more than that. We spend a lot more on detailing than we do on direct-to-consumer advertising, a lot more.
Which is I think, is...
But keep in mind, 50% of our detailing costs are free drugs. And again, you can argue, you know, so why do we give those free drugs away? Well, because we're hoping that people will become familiar and comfortable with our drugs, so they'll use more of them. That's the intent. But is that necessarily a bad thing? I don't know. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, and again, you got to understand, a lot of doctors won't see detail people, period. They won't. They don't have to. Nobody says you must see these detail people.
Yeah, but if
they think it's useful, and I'll tell you, my wife, you know, my wife's a primary care doc. She's very, very busy, and there's some detail people she'll see because they're useful, and there's some detail people she won't see because they're not.
Yeah, but if you have a ratio of 5 to 1 for detailing versus direct to consumer, 4 to 1 or 3 to 1 or whatever the number is, somebody's seeing them. And a lot of people, a lot of money is being spent on seeing the people that will be seen.
That's right. Oh, and I wouldn't dispute that for a second.
And it dwarfs the amount of money that's spent on direct-to-consumer advertising.
That's right.
Which is enormous in itself.
Compared to what? I don't understand that argument. I mean, you know, compared to what? How much did General Electric spend last year on promoting its products?
I have no idea.
Well, and so I don't understand the there's got to be some... You can't just say... You can't just make an assertion in a vacuum. I mean, you can't say that the drugs are over-promoted. And you have to sort of say compared to... I mean, I understand the rhetoric, and there are a lot of people out there saying we advertise too much and we promote too much. And the question I have is, compared to what? I mean, you know, compared to...
Well, compared to Budweiser, compare Vioxx and Budweiser, for example. I read, your reaction is curious to me because I just read that they spend more money advertising Vioxx than Budweiser spends advertising Budweiser to every consumer that's a legal age in this country. And I will never take Vioxx, hopefully. And I will never have a market for Vioxx. And I'll go to my office and I'll pull that study down for you if you don't believe
me. No, I'd like to see it. Yeah, I mean, that surprises me. And again, and my point is not, I don't think that there's a right or a wrong here. I mean, I think that Pfizer is in business to return money to its shareholders. And I don't think it's your job to sit there and say, you know, what's good for Pfizer? It's not, I understand that. But I do think it's important to put a lot of these criticisms in some perspective. Just so when we do what we do, we know what we're doing. You know, and I think that the direct-to-consumer advocate is such a good example of that because everybody's focused on the very few people who are inappropriately seeking a particular drug and the doctor writes the script. That's a very small number of people compared to the people who aren't being treated for the drug that should be. What about them? And that's my point. And again, similarly with the promotion, you know, so people don't like the fact that doctors get detailed. Well, when you look at where doctors learn about information about new drugs, they frequently learn about them from the detail people. Now, if you take the detail people away, again, what's the best thing for the most people? Is the question I think we have to ask. And what I'm trying to suggest is some of these things are complicated. I'd like to just get through this, and then you can I'll stay as long as you like.
One point is particularly to yours, Billy, about detailing, and that is I don't think this is I mean, you spoke, I think, accurately so that not every drug is appropriate for every person, but you take I'm probably going to Paxil, and what's the other competitive drug?
Zoloft.
I mean, an individual's detailing. I mean, Zoloft and Paxil are going to work for, I'm going to make an assumption here, probably the majority of that category of patient. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think it depends on what the syndrome is, but generally, okay. for a drug that's labeled for a particular indication, I think easily the majority are going to respond.
Just make that assumption. I mean,
sure.
So, I mean, these guys are acting in enlightened self-interest. I mean, that's a competitive market out there. You know, they see the detailer that gives, you know, Paxil, probably, and Zoloft. I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, they're getting their product that works in a competitive environment in front of, you know, the decider, the ultimate decider as to what product is going to be utilized.
That's right.
I think I would add too.
Profit motive.
Representative Weston, I'm not criticizing. Understand?
Right.
I'm not criticizing the practice of detailing. Although I suspect others on this panel might. But I was just pointing out merely that for people that don't understand that the pharmaceutical companies spend a whole lot more money on,
and that's
essentially,
right.
You know, direct to the physician advertising as opposed to direct to consumer advertising.
Well, and
I didn't hear you criticizing. I just want to say, hey, I mean, this is a competitive market. It's enlightened self-interest. It's
you got
I think
three
that's
drugs.
Part of the business.
Paxil, you know, and Zoloft to do the same thing. You got to get your script written.
Well, there's another important point that I think is important for the committee to understand. When we talk about DTC and we talk about detailing, you're talking about two very, very different things. Detailing a physician, our representatives are strictly limited on what they can say to a physician. Everything that every representation that they make about the drug has to be FDA approved. So it isn't happy people running across fields and dancing. It is the latest clinical studies that are available, the response rates. It's all very scientific information. And as you know, in this environment, with as much pressure as being put on physicians as there is right now, you got 2-3 minutes to get some important scientific information across. You can't waste time with the ethereal stuff.
Yeah.
All I can say, John, is I'm extraordinarily disappointed in you because with your scintillating presentation,
here it comes.
You had shut Spencer up, and then there he goes.
I was doing okay there for a minute.
Okay, until, you know.
I'll just step out.
So let me just finish up here, and then I'd be happy to take any questions. I know we're so just on the Me Too thing, just to finish up, I think the bottom line is what's best for the patient, and in terms of the clinical differences, and there can be very significant clinical differences. We just had a conference in Groton where we brought in a bunch of the leaders of the different disease area advocacy groups, and there was a gentleman who's the head of bipolar disorder national group, and to hear him talk about, so bipolar is very difficult to manage, and there's a lot of titrating of drugs, and it's a difficult clinical syndrome, and just to hear him talk about the idea of selecting one drug, having a closed formulary for bipolar disorder, this guy was just so passionate about how he titrates his drugs every week. I mean, that's how, and he's changing drugs constantly in consultation with his doctors. And so the idea that you can just sort of say, okay, guess what, we're going to pick a statin, is dangerous. One other point about I'm on statins. So the other problem is, suppose you pick one drug. Again, we go back to this sort of, what if you pick Bakol? I don't know if you remember, Bakol was a statin introduced by Bayer. And in Maine, they had a closed formulary, and they picked Bakol as the one statin that they were going to force all docs to write for the Maine Medicaid population. One week later, Bakol was withdrawn. Now, for safety issues. So one of the issues about the last thing we want is a single drug in the therapeutic category. That's a disaster. It's a disaster clinically. It's a disaster economically. And you will get zero additional funding to develop additional sources of new treatments if you go that route. It's a very dangerous idea. And then finally, when people talk about Me Too drugs, I mean, Me Too, what that means to me, again, is somebody sees somebody else do something and says, oh, I want to do one of those. So, and then a month later, they introduce their product. But as we've already talked about, it takes 10, 15, 20 years to introduce. You can't do that. You start a program. When drugs get introduced at the same time, that's usually pure coincidence, because they're both the programs that ended up in those drugs being introduced to the market were started at least 10 years before, and usually much more. So the idea that you can time the market for R&D is nonsense. It's ludicrous. You have no idea what's going to be on the market, and that's one of the reasons why it's so risky, because you just don't know. You might have a terrific product. Lipitor was the fifth statin introduced, the fifth, and I believe now it outsells all the rest combined. Now, it doesn't do that because it's promoted better. It does it because it drives the numbers and it drives better medical outcomes.
John, you're talking about a formulary, strict formulary. You can put reference based, you can put all those words in front of me. I understand your opposition to it, and I share those feelings. But Oregon's a managed care state. We have 14 contractors that have their own version of a formulary. Arrived at independently, those, if you overlaid them, they'd be 98% the same. A lot of generics on there. The differences come in, on some of the branded drugs where one's using Lipitor and one's using another statin. What's your opinion on these regionally based or locally developed formularies that where people have in managed care, it's risk, it's cost control, where a physician comes in, is making a decision, based not only on medical efficacy but cost containment, and he's sitting there going, first obligation, as I think we will all acknowledge and agree physicians do a wonderful job with, is treating the patient. Most of those drugs on that formulary work. He can make the decision, no, I'm going to give him brand XYZ or whatever it is. What's your opinion of these local or regionalized formularies?
Well, I mean, I think that the whole concept of a formulary is basically saying we want to restrict the choice of the people who participate in the provider. And typically we want to restrict that choice based on price. And what I so my opinion as somebody that whose salary is paid for by an organization that's trying to do research, so my own selfish interest here is ensuring the free flow of resources to do more and more and better research. From that perspective, anytime you're taking a good drug out of a formulary for pricing reasons, I think it's very short-sighted. And I'll tell you why. I think it's possible that there are drugs that you could substitute for a cheaper drug and get an equivalent medical outcome. Okay? The data on the ones that that I've seen are not very compelling. And the reason why is we have these silos. New Hampshire, in about 10 years ago, they had the same problem, and they decided for a particular patient population, i.e. patients with schizophrenia, that they were going to restrict them to 2 prescriptions a month. And they just sort of said, okay, we're going to do this. And they did it. And what they saw was that prescription costs went down, not surprisingly. I think it was 14% or something like that. It was not insignificant. Total health care costs to treat that patient population went through the roof at the same time. More ER visits, more, and that's my point. So you have to look. First of all, you can't stay in the drug silo. You've got to look across health care outcomes, and that's very difficult.
What I'm saying is that these guys aren't in a single, we're going to save 22 cents today. They're looking at the long compendium. Their organization is responsible for that patient.
Well,
ends up in the hospital.
I think maybe in some cases that's true. In most cases, if you look at the HMOs, the average churn from an HMO is 20% per annum. So they lose their entire population in 5 years. Now, that's not really true, but statistically, they lose a lot of people every year, and they lose most of their people over a 5 to 7 year time frame. Okay? And so what is their real incentive to invest in better cardiovascular health for a 38-year-old, relatively healthy person? I'm not sure. And again, it's another example of the silos. Because of the way that the health insurance system is organized, we don't have risk sharing. We've got, and it's all focused on acute. And if you can eliminate an acute cost today, do it. And if you can't do that, then eliminate an acute cost tomorrow, and so forth. And so you've got a silo by insurance status, which makes it very difficult for somebody to make those investments for the long term, which will pay the overall system. And you have a silo in terms of the administration, medicine's budget versus hospital's budget versus physician's budget. And those two silos conspire to make it very difficult to even measure what the impacts are of restricting access to meds. When you do that, when you look at specific examples of restricting access to medications, in the studies that I've seen, the costs, overall costs go up, and they go up a lot. And I believe that that's not an accident. I believe that that's probably... So when you ask me, what do I think about a formulary? Well, I can't tell you, listen, if you take this drug off of your formulary, your costs are going to go up. I wouldn't be that bold. But the anecdotal data that we've seen, and I've seen no good studies that contradict this, shows that it doesn't save money. It saves money for a certain party for a certain period of time. And I think we need to start thinking across these different silos and looking at, because look, we need better health care outcomes at a lower cost. There's no question about that. The only argument from my point of view is, how do you get there? And it's very difficult to measure now, and that makes the whole conversation. I mean, I come in and I work for Pfizer. Well, of course, I've got my point of view. And I happen to think I certainly try to work a lot harder at understanding people who are opposed to us, what they believe, than some other folks. But the fact of the matter is that you've got you have 300 million people in this country, all of them different. They use different healthcare in a different way. The way the system's administered, there are 45,000 different healthcare plans in this country, all with different rules and regulations. And trying to suss out from all of that, okay, you push this button and you save this money, is very difficult.
I think a key point also there is the level to which that formulary is restrictive.
And see, that's where I see John speaking from, and he used the word strict formulary, and that's one of the things that I actually give credit to some of these, you know, our contractors. They're fairly, probably not as much as, you know, you would support, but they're fairly nimble, they're fairly flexible.
So let me give you an example, though, because this just sort of stimulates something in my head. So we don't pay doctors for getting consults for poor patients. So my wife takes care of a lot of patients who don't have health insurance. She spends a huge amount of time begging doc specialists to see her patients. Right. And there is no CPT code for that.
Yeah.
Now this is, and the only reason I bring this up is this is a really good example of cost shifting, without that we don't see. That's not measured. You can't get a national database that says it cost us $300 million last year in doctors' time, because we decided that we were going to shift the responsibility to the doctor, to seek care for Medicaid, because in most states now fewer and fewer doctors are accepting Medicaid patients because the payment's getting so low. How do we measure that? And the fact is, we're doing it. I mean, look what we did. Look what we're doing with Medicaid reimbursement to hospitals. We're just reducing it unilaterally.
Well, the way we measure that is the cost shift and what it does to the commercial plans, and that's where I guess, you know, I take some exception to your earlier comment about, you know, why are drugs an issue? Well, because they're not covered. Hip replacement is. Look, what we're wrestling with and fighting, what you're wrestling with and fighting, is we functionally have a situation where medical technology is outstripping society's ability to pay for it. We don't know how to do this. I mean, it's not going to be solved by us sitting behind this dais. I mean, this is a federal issue that we need, you know, to change a societal priority on. I mean, is how I see it.
I think it's the same thing as with the food problem. I think we need to, the solution is technology, and we need to invest in the technology to make sure the solutions are there. I'm losing everybody, so let me just finish up here and then.
Well, you got the three that usually so.
I'm sorry, there's other folks left, because this is really an interesting point here. So I think everybody's read about the genome and how important it is. And I just wanted to spend a minute talking about what that means to us. So really, the genome for us means one thing. It means more targets. So we had probably 450 to 500 targets as of 3-4 years ago. And those are either receptors or ligands, or there's some place in the disease process to intervene. So we've all of a sudden got a tenfold increase in those targets, which is really exciting. And then, more importantly, these are all human receptors and ligands. So probably half of the other receptors and ligands were either mouse or rat, usually mouse or rat. So, you know, guess what? They're nice and they're very similar, but they're not human. So now all of a sudden we have 4,000 human receptors and ligands to go after. I mean, this is unbelievably exciting. So we can potentially develop much more specific medicines, to your point earlier, Mr. Chairman. But
they aren't home run medicines.
Well, they're not home run medicines, but more important than that, every one of those new mechanisms is by definition unprecedented. We spent 80 years exploring how insulin works in cells. So now all of a sudden, we've got a new understanding.
This is my favorite slide, by the way.
So this is from the American Journal of Physiology and cellular physiology. So this is what we knew in 1977 about insulin signaling. This is from a peer-reviewed journal. Even I understand that, right?
That's highly, highly technical.
Here's what it looks like now. And this is just glucose transport. This is not cell-cell interaction. This is just the glucose transport. So this stuff these are all new targets. This is incredibly exciting stuff. All of them potential areas where we could cure diabetes.
Could you have Mr. Spencer explain this slide to us?
All the ones in color, Pfizer...
Something happens.
All the ones in color, Pfizer has an active program ongoing right now. And guess what? All of those approaches are really exciting, potentially very rewarding, but they're risky as heck. The risks that I talked about before, those are based on statistics around research where we were looking at precedented mechanisms. Unprecedented mechanisms are 50 to 100 times riskier. So when you start talking about how exciting this is, it is, it's incredibly exciting. But we're talking about it in this environment where everywhere we turn around, people are trying to spend less money on their medicines.
And I guess the reason I was wanting to go there earlier, and I'm sorry a couple of the members are gone, was and the reason I mentioned the home run drug, because historically that's what you've gone for, is you've looked for a cure for something. And hopefully if you find that cure, it's going to serve just this whole universe of people, and you know, you'll get your money back. But what you're looking for now is a cure for a very small population of a larger population, and so the ability to get return for something that may be 100% effective is really problematic. And
right.
So I'm, you know, that's so, the thing I'm kind of weighing is you still got the same amount going into R&D, but your potential return is a lot less.
Right. So there's good news and bad news there. I mean, the point that the chairman is making is as we phenotype individuals, they're going to have predilection for one disease or another, and we'll know that better. And in some cases, you know, for example, Huntington's chorea, and we will know to a great extent. On the other hand, we will know where they don't work. And so as we look at understanding why, you know, Paxil and Zoloft and the other SSRIs work differently, as we understand the molecular basis for those differences, that's going to fragment the market for SSRIs into 100 splinters potentially. And thinking about amortizing the cost of this development over, you know, one splinter is daunting. The good news, though, is as we phenotype, as we move to a better understanding for the molecular basis of disease in all of us, we're also going to understand. So right now, if you think about what the status quo is, you may have a very high predilection for type 2 late, you know, adult onset diabetes, and you may not know it. Once we do your phenotype, we will know that. We'll have a much better insight. So on the one hand, the markets will get smaller. On the other hand, we will know with much greater assurance much earlier. So I think that the net effect of that is it's going to be plus minus. It's sort of like if we got a good prescription drug benefit in Medicare, would the price be exactly what the industry wanted? Probably not. But hopefully the expanded access and greater volume will more than make up for that. And I think that the implications, the business implications for the mapping of the genome are similar. You will have smaller compartments which you understand better, but you will also know everyone's phenotype to the extent that you want to. And in this country, I think we'll have the resources to do individual phenotypes for each one of us, certainly when we're seeking medical treatment. And that will provide, you know, the ability to get somebody on drug earlier for diseases that need to be treated now, that aren't being treated right now because you don't show up until you're symptomatic, which in some cases is too late.
I guess, you know, I took a tour of Scripps a few years ago, actually about 6 weeks before they officially announced the mapping, that they had completed the mapping, and everybody down there was just incredibly excited. I mean,
it's really
just a brand new world, and I'm looking at because if we can map in different ways now and we can identify in different ways, we're on the verge of curing a whole lot of things, specifically cancers that we might not have been before. But then I'm looking at the marketability of these things, where rather than taking a type of cancer and developing a drug to cure it, and you do testing and it turns out that it's 15% effective, well, it may be 100% effective for a certain group of folks, but then marketing that drug and getting the return, I mean, it's great stuff, yeah. But it,
well, that's, you know, that's already occurring. You're familiar with, right, the BRCA gene for breast cancer. Yeah.
Right. But the marketing side and the return side become somewhat problematic there, and that's, you know, when we talk about restricting R&D, which is what all this cost containment does, when we're moving into this new dynamic, really worries me, you know, because are we as policymakers going to decide which cancers are cured by that sort of decision? And that's the thing that bothers me. So
that's an excellent point. And that's sort of the whole point of this, of that section, is this is the time when there's the most promise for this work. There are more targets. There's more excitement. There's more information. There are more medicines to be mined. The pipeline is richer than the history of man. And we're right at the cusp of taking advantage of all the investments that we've all made collectively. And I worry very much about our ability to sustain, because, you know, the investments that we've made so far have set us up and put us in a position. I don't know if any of you see the wonderful story in the paper this morning about this SARS syndrome. And how we've already figured out that this is a coronavirus in like 3 weeks. And the reason we've done that is because of the technology we've invested in over the last 15 years. And they were comparing it. There's a wonderful story in the Wall Street Journal this morning about
the Asian thing.
Yes, the respiratory syndrome. Severe, I forget what the A stands for. In any case, we've completely transformed the way we've identified this virus from when we looked at the HIV virus to now, when and a lot of it is technology, and we've built this infrastructure. But the only way, so the discovery infrastructure is in place, the clinical infrastructure is not going to change much. You're still going to do clinical trials one patient at a time. It's still very expensive and still very risky. And so what I worry about is sustaining these investments so that we can, you know, exploit some of this potential that we're talking about.
But isn't there some conversation with the FDA when we're getting into these narrow universes as being able to kind of shorten their process a little bit as far as going to market? So that is occurring
now. Oh, yeah. It's a source of much debate.
Right.
So we're looking
at
a big biomarkers initiative, which is looking for genetic markers for predisposition to certain side effects, actually,
right.
And so forth. There's a lot of work going on in that area.
Go ahead.
So just to finish up, I mean, I think there are some myths that I've tried to talk about today. I mean, the idea that the business of developing medicines is a source of easy profits, I hope that I have at least suggested some data that would propose an alternative. There aren't any new entrants, at least in the small molecule market that we're in. There are very few survivors and fewer every day. You know, one of the other things is that we're really concerned about is that the U.S. public will continue to subsidize health care for the world. And that's not how we look at it now. Now it's really interesting. The way it's positioned in the U.S. is this is something that the pharmaceutical industry does. And it's very interesting. So if you look at Canada, for example, if you look at, has anybody ever heard of the McDonald's Index? It's in the Economist magazine, about every 3 months or so, they publish what it costs to buy a Big Mac in about 20 countries. And the reason it's interesting is when you translate across borders and you don't adjust for the changes in currency, it distorts everything you look at. So there's something in economics called the purchase pricing parity, where they adjust for the standard of living in the nation. When you adjust for the standard of living in the U.S. versus Canada and the difference in the fluctuations in the dollar, it takes care of almost all of the difference in prices for most products. So we did an example. I wish I had it with me. I believe Zoloft was the product, but it was a 30-day prescription for one of our products, and I believe it was Zoloft. And we looked at how many hours do you have to work to afford in that country to afford that medicine, and it was amazing. It was just like this. There were two outliers, Mexico, which you had to work twice as many hours, and France, which you had to work about a third less hours. Canada and the U.S. were almost identical. So when you adjust for this, when you look at it fairly, a lot of the differences in prices are differences in standard of living. You know, what's the U.S. dollar to right now? I think it's 62 cents to the Canadian dollar. Actually, it might be a little lower because we've been getting our currency's been eroding. So maybe it's up to 70 cents now. But that explains a lot of this price discrepancy. The other point about international pricing that it's, and again, it gets back to the point that I was trying to make earlier with Representative Tomei. You have to look at the alternative. If it's unfair to charge differential prices, then what that means is you should charge the same price everywhere. Well, what would that mean if we did that in Mexico? Maybe nobody could buy our medicines. What would that mean in Africa? What would that mean in poor countries? So is that the right answer? Is that a more moral and ethical way? You know, the way the system works now, is it perfect? No. But when you start exploring alternatives realistically, I mean, what people want is they want their cake and they want to eat it too. They want a new supply, continuous, of innovative new medicines, and they don't want to have to pay for them. And you guys are in the position of reconciling those two needs. And it's not an easy position to be in. But from our point of view, we understand the pressures on you. We understand the need for cost-effective medicine. We happen to believe that the appropriate use of good and innovative new medicines is the source for cost-effective treatment of medical problems. And we're very concerned that some of the short-term solutions, closed formularies being at the top of our list, are going to make it harder for us to control costs in the long run. So, anyway, thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry we went on for a long time.
Quick question, Mr. Chair?
You never ask a quick question in your life, but go ahead and try.
What can you do to help us with polydrug use, particularly in the mental health area where, you know, so many patients are taking 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 medications, none of which you've ever tested for in terms of that combination? Obviously, and may counteract each other. I mean, that's not only very expensive, but it doesn't really probably help patients.
Yeah, it's not a real good quality of life solution.
So the question about polydrugs is complicated. I think the first place that I would start is when we do our clinical trials, we, as I mentioned before, we are very careful about how we evaluate them.
Sure.
And we will look at drug-drug interaction to make sure that we don't get some kind of catastrophic result of putting two common drugs together. But the managing the individual pharmacopoeia of an individual patient is beyond the scope of what any pharmaceutical company can do. And really, you know, that is, you can have a safe drug, but using it safely is not the same thing. So, for example, Celdane, I don't know if you remember Celdane.
Yeah.
It was a great drug until another non-sedating antihistamine that didn't have the cardiovascular side effects came on the market, and then it was withdrawn. The point is that Celdane, it was possible to use Celdane in a dangerous way, and so it was withdrawn. And that's a very conservative thing. It's perfectly, I use Celdane, it was a great drug. But it was withdrawn because it could be used and it could be harmful. And that's the standard that we're held to, and I think that's appropriate. But when you look at the safe use of medicines, that's really, if you look at medical errors, if you will, as a source of bad healthcare outcomes, mostly those have to do with very boring things like, barcoding in hospitals, which Mark McClellan has just passed an initiative on. It has to do with the infrastructure and the logistics and the bureaucracy of giving out medications in institutions and hospitals. It has to do with drug compliance and older patients being able to read. It's a thousand little things that lead to better compliance, that lead to better use and safe use of drugs, once they're out in the general population.
Having two pills that look alike and do completely different things side by side on a shelf, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and actually a lot of that, you know, so there's a lot of work being done to address that. Also, the naming conventions are being looked at. So I think that there's a lot we can do on the industry side. I think that the most of the hard work, frankly, has to do with the safe use of medicines once they're in the hands of patients and doctors.
Doctors, and I guess that's where, we don't see this on the physical side. You get these just outrageous chemical soups going with.
We get some of them on the physical side, too. It's not as prevalent, but we do get a lot of 12 to 15 scripts, and so you have drugs counteracting drugs. And
I was going to say at these senior drug events that we've done around the state, I've done several of them now, it is not at all uncommon for these people to come up and have a list of 16 to 20 different drugs that they're on for conditions.
Yeah.
My first question I always ask them is, you know, are you seeing one physician or two physicians? Do these doctors know that you're taking these drugs in combination? Because at that point, you know, your odds for a bad interaction
are similar. Wow, 16 drugs, that's incredible.
Well, we had some members, individuals we all know well, several medical conditions taking 24 drugs.
24 different
24
drugs.
24 in the morning, 26 at night.
Now, different pills or different medicines?
Different pills.
See, you know, so for some of the HIV, regimes are, 24 pills in and of themselves.
If you're doing intensively invasive procedures, you got to have pills to, you have to have things that...
The immunosuppressant regimes are very rigorous.
That's a different universe. Yeah, that's not stuff we're
that's
talking
not what
about.
I'm talking about.
Right.
There are several
but 24 different medicines, that's very scary.
Morning, 26 at night.
Wow.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I think we're supposed to be on the floor. We are adjourned.
Thanks. Appreciate your patience.
Oh, this is great.
Thanks for coming.